You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Does it work? Does torture work? And the answer was yes, absolutely.
On torture, as on so much else, President Donald Trump continues to dispute the thinking of anybody who actually knows anything. My guests, Tom Rivers and Jeffrey Howard, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including UK Prime Minister Theresa May prepares to be the first foreign head of government to meet President Trump. An unseemly act of grovelling or nobly taking one for the team? And this week's far-right summit in Koblenz, can we at least hope that they might start fighting amongst themselves? And it's Australia Day, but should it be? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Tom Rivers, London correspondent for ABC Radio News, and Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both. And we will start in Washington, as yet not renamed by executive order, where US President Donald Trump has given his first major television interview. Much of this went pretty well true to form, in that he spent a goodly portion of it whining about the result of an election that he won, promising to launch an investigation into non-existent voter fraud, insisting that Mexico will pay for his wall and threatening to invade Chicago. Still more divertingly, he reaffirmed his enthusiasm for torturing terror suspects. Tom, first of all, the reassuring line taken or propagated by people who wanted to be reassuring during the campaign was that we should take him seriously but should not take him literally. Has the time now come to start taking him literally?
He has been really a busy president. And as you're absolutely right, I think the day of reckoning has come for many people in the country, saying, wow, he is actually following through on some of the things he said in the campaign. And we're watching it unfold before our very eyes. Case in point.
We used to complain about politicians keeping their promises.
Well, again, he's certainly got his constituents out there, and he certainly is satisfying them, but certainly the country is and remains polarized today, and how it's going to get together is anybody's guess.
Jeffrey, his thinking on torture is, to put it charitably, unorthodox. Why does he assume that he knows better than the entire senior strata of his military and intelligence services, all of whom have been queuing up to say that it doesn't work?
Well, what was so intriguing about that interview he gave recently with ABC News is he was asked whether torture works, and the exact reply was, do I feel it works? Absolutely, I feel it works. And that word feel he uses all the time. For Trump, there's this primacy he gives to gut emotion. He distrusts evidence, he distrusts facts, and I think a lot of his supporters like that about him. Of course, as we know, intelligence officials largely disagree about whether torture works, and you have many intelligence officials who think that building rapport with terror suspects is the best way to get information out of them, including Secretary of State James Mattis.
Well, intelligence officials not only believe that torture doesn't work. I mean, some I've spoken to myself have said it is, for obvious reasons, actively counterproductive, in that it just gives people who are not already inclined to like you even more reason to detest you.
Well, yeah, you will get people to talk, but the question is, will they say whatever you want them to say at that stage of the game? And reinforcing what Jeffrey said, Mattis, I think, said a couple of days ago. He says giving a detainee a beer and a cigarette probably is more productive than really coming down hard on somebody. And he's somebody that would know. Leon Panetta, again, former CIA director, shuddering at the fact that, lordy, we might be going back to the extreme rendition days. The saving grace may be that in that interview as well with David Muir, that the president says, look, I'm going to listen to my key advisors. And if they say I'm not going to go down this road, he says, well, he'll listen to them. Well, we'll find out in the coming days if he will.
Jeffrey, one of the other rationales that people have been trying to construct around Trump's outbursts are that this isn't just a creature of instinct spouting any mad nonsense that pops into his head, that this is all quite deliberate, that this is, if you will, a loyalty test, that he's trying to decide this early on who is willing to toe his line and who is not.
I think there's some truth to that. You know, a lot of Trump's appointments to the cabinet have been blindsided, the press has reported, by some of the statements he's made. It apparently, the incoming director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, was surprised that Trump made this statement about reopening these black sites around the world where torture would take place. And we know that they're surprised by this because many of these people are on the record saying that they're opposed to torture, not just because they think it's hard to get information out of people, not just because they think it's counterproductive and makes more enemies than it defeats, but because they have ethical objections to torture. They think torturing is something that's barbaric and it's something that's in fundamental conflict with American values.
Tom, Senator John McCain, who learned about torture the hard way, of course, and 5 years of it did not, as far as we know, turn him into an agent for Ho Chi Minh, has set himself up in opposition to this. He has said the president can sign whatever executive orders he likes, but the law is the law. We are not bringing back torture in the United States of America. How potentially important could resistance by an establishment Republican like McCain be?
Very, very good, because he vehemently opposed to it. He's got the credentials to say that as well. And if he wants to put up barriers, he certainly can. And he wants McCain on side. And I think it harkens back to the idea that the president will listen to other people and he may come on board. But yes, if McCain says that is the way it is, a lot of people in America, knowing his background, are going to be chiming in and saying, yeah, we're with him.
Well, we should consider some other recent developments, and I am getting the impression already that Trump's administration is going to be quite hard work for those of us trying to write topical news scripts. But in the last couple of hours, we have heard that the entire senior management team of the State Department has resigned, although in the last few minutes, the administration appears to be trying to spin that as a mass swamp-draining sacking. Also, the chief of the U.S. Border Patrol appears to have jumped ship. It's not clear yet either whether he has actually jumped or been compelled to walk the plank. Let's, Jeffrey, proceed on the assumption that these are principled resignations. Are they a good thing? Don't they just free up space for Trump loyalists to be inserted?
I don't think they're a good thing at all. When you get the Undersecretary of State for Management, the Assistant Secretary of State for Administration, for Consular Affairs, the Director of the Office of Foreign Missions, all of these people resigning, there's a huge amount of institutional memory.
We should stress that these are people who have served throughout several Democratic and Republican administrations.
Absolutely. These are nonpartisan civil servants who've served under both kinds of administrations. There's a huge amount of institutional memory there. And especially since you have someone coming in, Tom and I were talking about before the show started, Rex Tillerson's coming in, and he doesn't know his way around the State Department. He probably doesn't even know where the bathroom is. It's very, very important for there to be people who can teach him how the ropes work. And I'm absent learning further information. I'd say there's something actually ethically questionable about these resignations. They should have stuck around another month or 2 months to make sure that even if they did want to resign, their replacements learn the ropes.
Well, still, there's only 1,455 days to go, on which happy thought we shall move on. One of those days, tomorrow to be precise, Donald Trump will spend meeting British Prime Minister Theresa May. She will be the first foreign leader to visit him as president. All standard boilerplate about the special relationship, notwithstanding she arrives at a precarious moment. The United States apparently pulling up the drawbridges just as the UK desperately needs new friends. Tom, how much do we imagine Theresa May is looking forward to this?
Well, she knows this is a key player, and she needs that positive vibe coming out of a press conference after a meeting with the president on Friday to say, look, we can go out into the world, and we've got the U.S. of A. that's willing to cut a deal with us a lot quicker than we thought maybe back last spring, when it looked like maybe it would require a decade to hammer something out. So she needs the U.S. more than the U.S. actually needs the U.K. right now. And again, the people have been dwelling all day today on the various news channels in the U.K. here about the personal dynamics. They're very, very different. And frankly, irregardless of how they get on personally, I think the big business has to be that they have to strike something as a signal to the rest of the world that, yes, America can play ball with the rest of the world, even in light of things like saying we want to walk away from TPP. And Theresa May can say, look, we can cut deals one-on-one bilaterally with the superpower USA, and we can do that with a lot of other countries as well as we get into this whole Brexit mechanism.
All of which is doubtless true, but Jeffrey, how much is it going to be a calculation to be made not just by Theresa May, but by every single foreign leader, as to whether Donald Trump as a politician, as a human being, is so toxic that there is actually a domestic political cost to be seen to be getting too close to him?
I think many foreign leaders are going to face that challenging calculation. I don't think Theresa May has a choice here, though. I think she needs to go to Washington. Tom's exactly right. Theresa May needs Trump far more than Trump needs Theresa May. And I think the point of the visit is largely symbolic, to indicate to citizens, to consumers, that, you know, Britain outside of the EU is going to have some pretty powerful friends in the world. That said, if Brits don't like taking orders from Brussels, they're really not going to like taking orders from Washington. And, you know, if there's ever any kind of trade deal that's meaningful, Britain's going to have to shred its consumer standards, its environmental protection standards, its employee standards to get down to the levels of the United States, which means hormone-infused beef, chlorine-washed chicken, all this stuff they sell in America that they don't sell in the UK. Is Britain willing to do that? And if so, will the British public be upset with that?
There's also all that weird-tasting chocolate and terrible, terrible coffee we have to look forward to as well. Tom, to what extent do we think that Theresa May subscribes to that common, well, I don't know if delusion is definitely necessarily the right word, but it's certainly a common fantasy of the UK Prime Minister as a wise guiding counsel to their perhaps impetuous American equivalent? This is the Greece to their Rome is the traditional formulation, though we might not want to be bandying around the names of collapsed empires with too much abandon just at the moment.
Well, again, look, you talk about the American public, and, you know, when think back when George W. was talking about, "Wash, we have to invade Iraq," and so many Americans said, "You got Tony Blair. He's a pretty bright guy. He thinks it's a good idea." So, you know, yes, Theresa May can be really bright and clever. And again, the name recognition in America right now is pretty low. She is not a Tony Blair. She is not a Margaret Thatcher. But if she plays her cards right, John Doe on the street will know who she is after this trip is over. And yeah, she can play an important role.
Jeffrey, what can or should she be looking for in terms of Donald Trump's commitment to NATO?
Well, I was going to mention this exact issue because we know during the campaign that Trump has called NATO obsolete. This stands in stark contrast, like so many of Trump's beliefs, with the convictions of his cabinet secretaries. Jim Mattis in defense has said that if NATO didn't exist, we'd need to invent it. He thinks it's that important as an alliance. One of the first calls that Mattis made was to the Secretary General of NATO. So clearly there's some question about the degree to which Trump is going to listen to his advisors on this issue. Is he going to listen to Jim Mattis on this, or is he going to go with his own gut? And I think Theresa May is going to try to persuade him to go with Jim Mattis on this. I think Theresa May is going to make the case for NATO, and I think it's crucial that she does.
I think that there can be some tweaking, though. And for years, there have been these calls, when are you guys going to pay 2% of GDP? And, oh, we're going to do it next week, and it never, ever happens. The UK does. But most of the other NATO members do not. Also, he brings up this important point. And for the first time, when NATO went off the map, so to speak, in Afghanistan, the rules changed. And then we can go to bomb in Libya. And I think if Trump wants to strongly pursue this, he can say, let's go back to our original mandate and as protect the countries in Europe. And if one's attacked, we will all come to their defense. But no, this is not a private army that we can point in any direction on the planet and say, go get them. It's a different world.
Well, on the subject of Donald Trump meeting foreign leaders, we should also mention other news breaking in the last hour or so, which is that the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, has cancelled next week's scheduled meeting. This is obviously no small change. Mexico, quite aside from being the United States' neighbor, is the United States' third largest trading partner. Jeffrey, I struggle to think of a precedent for this. I can't imagine that there has been one, somebody declining to meet with the President of the United States in his first week on the job. It's usually thought of as incredibly prestigious.
I think the Mexican people saw Trump's rhetoric in the past week as such an outrageous insult to their country, that I think, in terms of his domestic political situation, the leader of Mexico simply had no choice here. I think it's going to possibly be something that, Trump respects in the long run. It's possible that Trump will respect him for standing up to him and not being a pushover. Time will tell, but it definitely portends pretty icy relations between the United States and Mexico that we can't remember happening anytime recently.
What do you think, Tom? I mean, it is, as Jeffrey points out, hard to imagine that this is going to go over badly at home for President Nieto, who took a fair bit of heat last year for seeming to be too friendly to Donald Trump when he visited. But who makes the next move, and what should that next move be?
Well, it's interesting. Sean Spicer on the plane to Philadelphia had been telling the gaggle that, yes, the communications are still open. Now, this meeting was supposed to be next Tuesday. They're going to find something in the calendar. Who knows? Weeks down the road, a month down the road, you know, and both parties to say, well, we stood our ground. Now we can get down to some work. And no one is a real loser if that happens. So I think this is kind of we're in the first round and we're sizing each other up. And no one has even swung a punch yet. But, you know, that'll come down the road, but we're not there yet. It's fascinating.
Fascinating is one way of putting it, certainly. Jeffrey, are we likely to see much more of this? It goes back a bit to what we were talking about earlier. If national leaders start to calculate that it is potentially of immense political domestic advantage to be seen to be refusing to engage with Donald Trump, might we start to see more no-shows? And what does that mean for the United States' prestige in the world?
I think it's entirely possible that we're going to see more no-shows. Listen, Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize simply because he was a person other than George W. Bush, right? And a lot of that was about this idea of America reclaiming its place as the leader of the free world, as someone that could be a partner in advancing the aims of international peace and cooperation. But with Trump's slogan of America First, with his aim to turn inward, I think Trump is sending a very, very clear message to the rest of the world that you're not going to be able to rely on America anymore to be the leader of the free world. And that's very dangerous.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tom Rivers and Jeffrey Howard. Coming up next, far-right nationalists gather in medium-sized German city. What could possibly go wrong, etc.?
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, a program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Rivers and Jeffrey Howard. Now, for all President Trump's apparent isolationist instincts, he is not an isolated phenomenon. Further illustration of this, if such were needed, manifested earlier this week in Koblenz, the lucky German city hosting a conclave of bellicose far-right nativists from across Europe, including such charmers as French National Front leader Marine Le Pen, the Dutch Freedom Party's Geert Wilders, Matteo Salvini of Italy's Northern League, and Frauke Petri of Alternative for Germany. Tom, this was obviously intended as a show of strength. How impressive was it as such?
Well, see, I was looking at the polls just yesterday, just seeing what's happening in the Netherlands. And Wilders' numbers are looking stronger than I expected at this stage of the game. And Le Pen, who knows what happens in May? So, yes, they are a strange collection of individuals who oftentimes do not sing from the same sheet. But, you know, the question I have this year as a person reporting in this part of the world is what we saw with Brexit. And America going to be transformed into some political continent changes, another domino. Will it be the Netherlands? Will it be France? Will it be Germany? Fill in the blank. It's going to be fascinating to watch this political, if you will, drama played out in 2017.
Tom, you keep using this fascinating word.
I think. Well, I think it's a time that, you know, we can go through boring times watching politics, et cetera, et cetera. We are at a time that you and I have never seen before, and we have to go back maybe to the 30s when there were such dramatic political changes afoot, and we have to see exactly how it plays out.
This is true. We have not seen this before, but there are, of course, probably within living memory, Europeans who have. Jeffrey, is this blood and soil nativism we are looking at now, is it, to your mind, an entirely new thing, disconnected from similar things in the past, or is it just stuff that just never really went away and is enjoying a resurgence?
I think it's enjoying a resurgence. I think that democracies have always had this populist element, this nativist nationalist element that says the purpose of a country is to serve the people of that country and the people whose ancestors lived in that country. There was this quote in the inauguration where Trump says, "It is the right of all nations to put their own interests first," where nation has a very strongly nationalist cultural interpretation of what kind of people count in your definition of the nation. And it's that idea that you put your own people first, that I think is the philosophical thread line that goes through all these different groups. And it's predicated on the idea that there are some people in the society who are the real people of the society, the real citizens, and there are some people who aren't the real citizens. Immigrants are not part of the real citizenry, and that's a theme that we see in all of these movements.
It does start to get messy when you start deciding where those lines lie, of course. Happy thought on this for you, Tom. Mm. Is it possible that the European variation of this might actually be more virulent and more dangerous than the American one? Not just because of Europe's fairly gruesome history in this respect, but also because the United States, though it has elected president who it has elected president, does think of itself quite genuinely, I think, as a nation of immigrants in a way that few European countries do.
Wow, that's a heavy duty question. As you say, the history says this thing can go very, very badly if you stack up the right ingredients. I'm not sure. I really don't know. One thing Jeffrey was talking about, the people that feel that they are the part of the country and as opposed to people that might be identified as immigrants. I think another way of looking at it is to put the lens of the widening wealth gap. And of course, Trump has echoed this and going back for, say, 40 years. Other countries will interpret it their own way, but they're seeing, you know, economically that they're not playing ball anymore, and they haven't for many, many years. And different people in different countries are interpreting it in different ways. But I think if you want a common thread, economics is there as well.
Well, finally tonight, we will look to my own homeland, for today is Australia Day, an occasion which Australians such as myself increasingly celebrate by arguing about the meaning of Australia Day. It commemorates the arrival of the first convict fleet in 1788 and the inaugural hoisting of the Union Jack at Sydney Cove very shortly thereafter. As such, many Indigenous Australians and many non-Indigenous Australians, with some appreciation of what the last 229 years have been like for Indigenous Australians, have mixed feelings about the whole thing. Jeffrey, first of all, national days as an idea, as a thing in themselves, do they serve a useful function?
Sure, why not? I think they can serve a useful function if they're put to good use. Mm-hmm. If they're just an excuse for people to take the day off from work, I don't know if people have the day off from work in Australia.
We do for Australia Day. I think. It's a public holiday. It must be. Surely it is. We have one for Melbourne Cup Day, or at least in Victoria. We must have one for Australia Day.
See, I think that might be a mistake. I think you want kids in school on Australia Day, just like you want kids in school on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, because I think the purpose of these days is to facilitate a certain kind of public reflection and public introspection, which is why I think it's fully appropriate on Australia Day to take stock of the injustices, for example, committed in Australian history, to think about the plight of Indigenous people, and then to have a conversation about what the priorities are of Australia moving forward. And if the days are used constructively like that, rather than just a chance to take time off and hang out and go to the movies, I think that can have some value.
This has been the weird thing I've noticed in the evolution of Australia Day, though, and it changed, I remember noticing quite dramatically on the Bicentennial centennial one in 1988, that which was a much less jingoistic thing than I'd been bracing myself for, largely because of quite intelligent campaigning by Aboriginal Australians to point out that there were a couple of different ways of looking at this. I agree with that entirely, but nonetheless, Tom, there are still occasionally suggestions that the date should be changed. The city of Fremantle this year tried to move it unilaterally to January 28th. According to the most recent polling, 15% of Australians think the date should be shifted. How do you think a country, not just Australia, but any country, should deal with a national day which does have an ambiguous genesis? We're not the only country that was established at gunpoint.
I guess it becomes tradition then, and as the years go by, you know, whatever it is, it is, and it's hard to change that. It's hard to change the date, and people get used to it. And getting back to what Jeffrey said about, you know, how things change over the decades. When I was young, 4th of July was baseball, apple pie, Chevrolet, and that was all into the equation now. Look what we're living in 2017, talking about Standing Rock now. And so many American vets going out saying, look, you got to take care of the indigenous people here and take care of the natural resources. Something that you wouldn't have not heard in the 50s or the 60s. Changing times.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess they evolve as all symbols can evolve. Britain, interestingly, does not actually have one, a designated national day. Should it?
It's probably for the best. I think that if you have these national days, then maybe we can make good use of them. We don't need to abolish them. But you wouldn't go creating it afresh. It's kind of like the monarchy, right? You know, given that we have it, let's put it to good use. But if we didn't have it already, we shouldn't invent it, that's for sure.
Because there have been attempts, or at least there are. Gordon Brown did float this, the idea of a British national day. But can you even begin to imagine the rows that would occur over what date it should be?
Oh, exactly.
How one should go about commemorating.
Exactly. I think you're looking at a minefield, and I think you would find absolutely no common thread at all, and you would only find discord.
Do you think, though, that going back to what you were saying, Jeffrey, about how the date can be perhaps useful as a means of discussing a country's difficulties or its ambiguous history, as well as celebrating what it is that something you think that government should direct, or should they be happy to let the people figure out their equilibrium on that one themselves?
I think the government can and should direct it through education and through civic education, and I think schools and universities really should be places where people take stock of their history. I mean, there was this big controversy at Oxford a little while back about the statue of Cecil Rhodes, asking whether we should move it to the museum, whether we should abolish it. And my view was always, well, leave it where it is, and have some kind of plaque that mentions the injustices committed in his name. Look history square in the eye with all its moles and imperfections. Mm. And don't try to whitewash it and pretend that the bad things of the past didn't happen. I think it's perfectly appropriate for government to try to push its citizens to engage in that kind of reflection in a democracy.
How would that play, though, in the United States, Tom? I mean, it's not something we can probably imagine the current president doing. But if one of his successors was to use July 4th to kind of... to channel July 4th, that is, to try and talk about, you know, legacies of the dispossession of the Native Americans or of slavery or of whatever else you're having, how well do you think that would go over?
I think I'm just talking, you know, out of blank space here. But I think that it might go down well. Who knows? I think some people are open to that. Some people certainly wouldn't be, but some people might say, yeah, that's important, and that we should get those facts out there. And we should all know some of the history that maybe A is not actually focused on in schools, or maybe we've forgotten.
Well, it's a speech to look forward to Elizabeth Warren giving in 2021, perhaps. on that note, Tom Rivers and Jeffrey Howard, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Helena Geriat, and Elisa Mayer. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist. We'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.